the Missile Defense Agency was buying, producing, and then placing these interceptors without really knowing whether they could work as intended.
A new report raises doubts about the missile defense system at Fort Greely. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 18th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, lawmakers signal their willingness to invest in behavioral health, even in tough budget times.
I view it in the same way as investing in oil and gas tax credits for exploration. It pays off in the long run, though it costs a bit up front.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're looking for a career that will put you to work immediately without any educational debt, think about the apprenticeship program and learn to become a construction craft laborer. The construction industry requires hard work, provides great pay, and a bright future while building Alaska. Application deadline for the apprenticeship program is March 31st. Call to begin your debt-free career track today, 907-345-3853. This message sponsored by Alaska Laborers Training School.
Yesterday, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski told reporters she believes it's important that the Senate hold a hearing on President Obama's choice to replace Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court.
I do believe that the nominee should get a hearing.
Late this afternoon, in a series of five Twitter posts, Murkowski said she doesn't think the nominee would deserve a vote on the Senate floor. In fact, the Senate senator now says Obama shouldn't make any nomination. She's said on Twitter she's urging Obama to follow what she said was a traditional embrace by both parties and let the next president make the nomination. Quote, if POTUS ignores precedent, she tweeted, I believe extraordinary circumstances give the Senate every right to deny the nominee an up or down vote. Spokesman for Senator Dan Sullivan wouldn't say whether Sullivan believes an Obama nominee deserves a Senate hearing, but the spokesman did say Sullivan will likely oppose any of the president's choices. A new report raises doubts about whether the missile defense system housed largely at Fort Greely can protect the U.S. from a North Korean attack. The Government Accountability Office says the Missile Defense Agency is compromising reliability with a rush schedule as it expands the number of ground-based interceptors in Alaska to 40. Christina Chaplin, the report author, says the problem is the missile agency's acquisition process. Chaplin says the agency overlapped the testing and production phase for its new missiles to meet a 2017 deadline for installing them in the field.
In essence, the Missile Defense Agency was buying, producing, and then placing these interceptors without really knowing whether they could work as intended. And as you can imagine, that caused a number of problems.
Among the problems is a series of failed tests, which can cost more than $200 million apiece. Chaplin says the agency's approach to developing ground-based missile defense has contributed to a cost increase of more than $1 billion and caused years of delay.
So even though you're in a rush and you're trying to get something in quickly, you may end up waiting longer for it because you're continually in a cycle of correcting problems and testing them again. And you're also in a continual cycle of having to pay for tests when they don't work, and they're very expensive.
The Missile Defense Agency did not issue a report to a response to the GAO report when it came out yesterday. Spokesman said today they're still reviewing it. The University of Alaska is opposing a bill introduced by a Fairbanks state senator. SB 174 would remove restrictions for the carrying of concealed firearms on college campuses. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the bill received a vetting yesterday by Senate Education Committee.
Senator Pete Kelly told the Alaska Senate Education Committee Tuesday that his bill, SB 174, would remove a constitutional wet blanket UA policy puts on students, faculty, and staff to bear concealed firearms on campus. Kelly reeled off a series of past shootings on campuses and suggested they might have ended without as much death if students and faculty were carrying a gun.
Bad guys with guns are stopped by good guys with guns. And if the university has made it so all the good guys can't have guns, they are then at the mercy of bad guys with the guns.
In response to questions from the committee, Kelly wasn't able to name any situations on UA campuses where having a concealed firearm would have helped the situation, and he conceded state law does bar concealed handguns from the legislative chambers, but he offered that situation could be remedied with future bills. The Education Committee also heard from UA President Jim Johnson, who outlined five broad categories the school objected to in the current bill. Johnson says the university is like the courts, the legislature, and K-12 schools where concealed firearms are barred.
Such places have been recognized by the courts and by the Alaska legislature as sensitive places in which regulation of firearms is presumptively lawful.
Senator Kelly told the committee he thought the university had some good points and was willing to amend the bill to accommodate them. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Medicaid is one of the biggest drivers of Alaska's state spending. At the same time, Alaska has the nation's highest suicide rate and a growing problem with opioid addiction. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports on an effort to address both issues.
State leaders believe they can lower the long-term growth in Medicaid costs and make Alaskans healthier mentally and physically. They plan to do that by better coordinating behavioral health care, the treatment of mental health and addiction. At a recent Senate Medicaid Reform Subcommittee hearing, Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson said it will be a challenge.
This is hard stuff. If it was easy, Alaska would have done it long ago. And the great news is that we have folks who have come together who are really interested in really changing the way that we deliver behavioral health services in our state so that Alaskans can get the care that they need.
In practice, it means more Alaskans will be screened for behavioral health issues in primary care settings, and a wider range of licensed counselors and therapists would be able to treat Medicaid recipients in a wider range of settings, like in a doctor's office. Davidson says current gaps in behavioral health care lead to other problems.
We are seeing it in the number of children who experience child maltreatment. And unfortunately, when we're dealing with children, what we know is to the extent that that occurs, that can become a multi-generational issue, that if we don't provide resources to family members who are in crisis, where we have places where they can actually go to receive help, we are never going to get ahead of this problem.
A recent state-commissioned report recommended the state hire an organization that would increase the state's capacity to provide behavioral health care and manage a coordinated system. While that organization would cost more than $5 million per year starting in 2018, the state projects that it would save a larger amount of money in future years. Despite the state's massive budget deficit, Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel was on board.
I appreciate the encouragement to invest in behavioral health, and frankly, I view it in the same way as investing in oil and gas tax credits for exploration. It pays off in the long run, though it costs a bit up front.
This coordinated approach already is practiced in some areas. For example, South Central Foundation serves Alaska Natives with psychologists and social workers who treat patients in the same health centers as primary care providers. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board supports better integration of behavioral health care into the rest of the healthcare system. Chief Executive Jeff Jesse says state leaders and providers will have to work together like a baseball team.
The trustees believe this is the single biggest thing that the trust will encounter in our 20 years of history. This is an opportunity to truly transform our behavioral health and healthcare system. So it's the bottom of the ninth. We're five runs down. We're not bunting. And we're not going to get in one big swing either. We're going to have to chunk away at this.
While the groundwork for state behavioral health changes would happen over the next year under Governor Bill Walker's proposed budget, the bulk of the changes wouldn't occur until 2018. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the bumpy road to opening a marijuana business in Anchorage.
The biggest hurdles have been, I can name quite a few. One has been connecting with other cannabis folks.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A 26-year-old Palmer man is facing federal charges on distribution of heroin resulting in a death. Acting U.S. Attorney Kevin Feldes announced the charges today in Anchorage. Hiram Lewis DeCasey Jr. is the only defendant named in the three-count indictment. DeCasey is being charged with conspiracy to distribute heroin, distribution of heroin resulting in a death, and possession with intent to distribute. Kevin Feldes.
It's a tragedy in so many ways. It's a tragedy that we have a 26-year-old individual charged today with these federal felonies who thought that he could profit from selling heroin to others. And of course, it's mostly a tragedy because we have a victim, a 22-year-old male, who died, as it's alleged in the indictment, as a result of using this heroin.
The deceased man is only referred to by the initials MC in the charging documents. He died in December after using drugs sold to him by DeCasey on November 30th. Feldes says the DeCasey indictment is the fourth time that federal charges have been brought against an Alaska dealer in a case resulting in death. Federal and state drug enforcement officials worked with the Alaska state troopers on the case. Trooper Colonel James Cockrell says the heroin epidemic is hitting rural Alaska especially hard.
There's not a village out there that's not affected by heroin, alcohol, or meth. And it's not only that, it spawns all kinds of other crimes. Most of our property crimes in our urban areas, the Matsu Valley, the Kenai Peninsula, it's all drug fed. No different than the villages where they have very little cash. They got to get that money from somewhere. So what do? They sell bootleg alcohol and then they buy drugs to support their habits.
Attorney Feldes says DeCasey could face a 20-year sentence. He'll be arraigned in federal court in a few days. A former Juneau representative has been fined over $18,000 for allegedly asking for an oil company job while sitting as a state lawmaker who helped draft oil tax legislation. But his attorney said the opinion released by a legislative ethics committee may not be the final word on the matter. KTOO's Matt Miller has this report.
The House subcommittee of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics released their probable cause complaint against Bruce Weirach on Tuesday, after 10 meetings on the case over the last 9 years. The Ethics Committee alleged Weirach violated the Legislative Ethics Act by obtaining a promise of future employment with oil services company VECO for helping to draft the petroleum profits tax bill that was being pushed by then-Governor Frank Murkowski. They also found that Weirach agreed or implied that, in exchange for the potential job, he would make sure the bill benefited VECO. The committee also determined that he exerted official influence on other lawmakers by encouraging them to vote the same way on the oil tax bill, also known as PPT. The committee determined that Weirach had 51 amendments drafted for the bill as the legislature met in the spring of 2006. That same year, he sent 6 letters soliciting clients and employment, and of those, 1 letter each was sent to VECO, BP Exploration, and ExxonMobil. He also offered his office space to an out-of-state VECO attorney. The panel said Weirach's actions demonstrated a conflict of interest, even though there was no evidence that he ultimately was employed by VECO. Reached for comment on Wednesday, Weirach referred all questions to his attorney, Doug Pope, and Pope said they contest everything that's in the probable cause finding other than the fact that Bruce was a legislator. Pope said Weirach cooperated with the committee, but he said it was time for the panel to prove their claims and justify their decision before a court of law. Pope suggested the process will likely go on for a while longer, but not nearly as long as the Ethics Committee took with their investigation. Pope said the sword has been hanging over Bruce and wife Luann's head for too long. Weirach served in the State House representing a portion of Juneau for 4 years starting in 2003. He was indicted in May of 2007 after a corruption probe by the U.S. Department of Justice that resulted in the indictments of other lawmakers like former House Speaker Pete Cott, former Wasilla Representative Vic Coring, and U.S. Senator Ted Stevens. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder moved to throw out Stevens' conviction because of prosecutorial misconduct before Stevens died in a plane crash in 2010. Weirach eventually pled guilty to a misdemeanor state charge of aiding an unregistered lobbyist after federal prosecutors dropped 4 felony charges against him. Weirach was fined $1,000 and received a suspended sentence of 3 months in prison during his sentencing in March of 2011. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
As the state readies for the implementation of a legal cannabis industry in the next few months, we are profiling one business along every step of the way. Jane Stinson is hoping to open a family-run retail shop in Anchorage, but the last few months of tracking regulations, securing a location, and figuring out how to start a new business that banks won't lend you has not been easy. Jane Stinson is not exactly who you think of as the face of legal pot in Alaska. She's in her 60s, tall, with the calming presence of a sturdy aunt.
I've been in Alaska for 36 years, and my background has been in the oil and gas industry, so I have my career there and just recently retired.
Stinson and I are talking in her car, just outside the noisy Anchorage Eatery where we met up.
We are at the Middleway Cafe, and I had a smoothie for breakfast.
A few years ago, Stinson first had the idea to start a commercial cannabis business, but the timing wasn't right. Ballot Measure 2 hadn't yet gotten voter approval, and Stinson wanted to wait until after her retirement. But she did have an ideal relationship with her two other business partners.
We are a family-owned business.
But that brings its own challenges. Basically, she doesn't want to get her family members in trouble. Stinson says there's a very real risk to a person's career if they're out as being involved in the cannabis business. And that's the reason she's so careful using the names of her business partners during our interview. The name of their business venture, though, that is fair game. It's called Enlighten Alaska.
So Enlighten is, we want to enlighten Alaska about cannabis.
Stinson talks about the business in mission-driven terms. She hopes to see crime that's connected to the black market dissolve and be able to provide reliable information about the potential health benefits of cannabis to future consumers. And that personal passion, that is a necessary business ingredient because the arithmetic of adding time plus money into a variable new industry has not penciled out so far.
The biggest hurdles have been, I can name quite a few. One has been connecting with other cannabis folks. As you know, it's very underground right now, but people are bubbling up and wanting to start a viable business. So that's been difficult to talk with others, but we've been managing to do that.
That lingering stigma matters more than you might think. For example, it's not easy for Stinson to get connected with suppliers. You can't exactly Google where to buy wholesale weed in Anchorage and find useful, legal answers. Likewise, there is a vexing question around real estate.
Property owners are tied to banks in many instances and are not able to lease to cannabis businesses because of that. So that's a big hurdle.
Stinson has been working for months to secure a lease for a retail space, and after many disappointments, she is really close. But because the landlord might face sanction from his bank, she can't tell me his name. So imagine drafting a business plan, but you can't be certain of the location. The regulations at the state and local level, those are an ongoing process, and you can't finance through a major lender. It's got to be cash. That logistical obstacle course is part of what led Enlighten Alaska to scramble its original business plan.
Initially, we wanted to have three different licenses. That would be a grow license, a processing license, and a retail license. We decided after 6 to 8 months of planning that we were just going to focus on retail for now.
It simply got too cumbersome to figure out regulations, zoning, and financing for three different business models under the same umbrella. So for now, Enlighten is tracking the local rules for commercial retail shops, issues like how far they have to be from schools, the security requirements around the building, and whether on-site consumption will be legal by the time they open their doors a few months from now. We'll follow Stinson and her business throughout the next phase of the evolving process, filing for a license, signing a lease, finding suppliers, and one day, maybe even opening shop in Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The 2016 Iron Dogs Snow Machine Race gets underway this weekend. The ceremonial start in downtown Anchorage begins Saturday morning, and then the green flag officially drops at the Big Lake starting line on Sunday at 11 a.m. As KIYU's Tim Bodoni reports, Iron Doggers are expecting a better trail than last year.
A lack of snow on the north slopes of the Alaska Range and the Farewell Burn presented a big challenge to racers last year, prompting many to add supplemental radiators or fans to their machines to prevent overheating. Even then, the racers were forced to reduce speed and travel as a pack over more than 50 miles of bare ground. But this year, despite Alaska's below-average snowfall totals, the trail appears to be snow-covered for almost all of its 2,000-mile length from Big Lake to Nome and then to Fairbanks. Iron Dog Executive Director Kevin Kastner is expecting a fast race.
You get sort of past Squintna and up to Shell Lake, it gets better and better. And even sections out of Roan and over the burn and all of that about as fast as it's ever been. So right now, predictions are to be a fast race, which fast can also mean more accidents. So we're hoping that they keep it under control. But so far so good. I think the overall trail should be a good one.
Like last year, the usual race trail on the Yukon River between Caltag and Galena will need to be rerouted due to open holes around Keokuk. Iron Doggers will take the Overland Portage Trail on the north side of the river between Keokuk and Galena. That area is the home turf of Iron Dog Team 27, Bobby Frankson and Joe Cleaver. They've entered the race twice before as partners, in 2006 and 2009, but have never finished. Speaking from the safety inspection in Anchorage on Wednesday, Frankson said that the week before the race is a relentless push to get ready.
Countless hours of turning wrench and dialing in and doing this and that. I drove into Anchorage at 4 o'clock in the morning and got up at 7, and here I am at the expo, and apparently I'm not the only one.
41 teams are signed up in the competitive pro class, and 7 more are in the non-competitive recreational class. Polaris is the most popular make of snow machine in the race, with 19 teams signed up. Ski-Doo is second with 12. 8 teams are riding Arctic Cats, and only 2 have chosen Yamaha. Polaris machines have crossed the finish line first 2 years in a row, and 5 out of the last 7 years. A first-place prize of $65,000 is up for grabs as part of a $260,000 purse. The winning team is expected to arrive at the finish line in downtown Fairbanks at around noon on Saturday the 27th. In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
The Yukon Quest is winding down. The last musher, Canadian rookie Gaetan Piard, is expected to cross the finish line early tomorrow morning. Running at the back of the pack can be just as trying and rewarding as racing at the front. As KUAC's Molly Reddick reports, that was the case for rookie mushers Andy Pace and Lauren Neese.
The youngest musher in the Yukon Quest finished the race on Wednesday night in 13th place. Earlier that day, with only 100 miles left, she said she wasn't ready for it to be over.
We got in here and it hit me. This is the last checkpoint. I don't want it to be done.
Last week, a blizzard on American Summit brought several mushers to their knees, stranding some in cabins and forcing others to camp in the howling snow. Several were still in shock when they came into Dawson City. But Niece said it was her favorite part of the race.
The storm was really cool, just to see the dogs in that new experience.
Niece is 19 years old and has dreamed of running the Yukon Quest since elementary school. She finished high school and college early to become a long-distance dog musher. In the mountains between Eagle and Dawson, she ran into the worst conditions she has ever seen. The trail had been wiped out by snow and wind, and she had to break through deep snowdrifts.
The drifts were deep enough the dogs were just swimming in them.
Not only did Niece make it through with a smile, she helped another musher through, too. Andrew Pace is a 36-year-old rookie from Healy. His team started the race strong, but partway through he had to drop his lead dog, Solo, because of pneumonia. When he left Eagle and headed into the mountains, he was missing his main leader. He made it over the first summit, but started having trouble on the second one.
Then the wind started coming, and then the snow started coming, and then the kind of ice snow, and it was pretty nasty.
Pace was working as hard as he could to help his dogs up the hill, running, ski poling, and kicking to give them more momentum, but they just didn't want to pull.
I was just drenched in sweat, and I had already done that on American Summit, so my backup clothes were already ice blocks in my sled.
With no other options, he stopped to camp again. Because they were moving so slow between checkpoints, he had run out of dry clothes and dog food. He was worried he might have to activate his emergency beacon and scratch from the race.
So at that point, I just thought, you know, I don't want to do it, but if I don't have another dog team to follow in right now, I'm going to have to press a button or I'm going to have to walk them in.
On long distances or in rough conditions, dogs can lose the will to pull. Sometimes all they need is something to chase. So Pace wrote a note and posted it on his ski pole next to the trail, hoping a musher would see it.
Dog team won't go. Help. Hung it up, got in my sleeping bag, and just went to sleep for a little bit.
Soon he saw a headlamp coming over the hill. Niece had been seeing Pace's tracks for a while. She didn't know who it was, but she could tell they were having trouble.
Came up on him and it was obvious he was camped, not planning to be camped. So I passed and stopped and asked if he wanted to follow.
He did. Pace lined out his team and started running again, following Niece through the night. Every few minutes, he saw the flash of a headlamp as she turned around to check on him. Soon, his dogs were back in race mode.
Oddly enough, that last run, I was riding the brake like a banshee the whole way in.
Pace said the teenage musher was his savior that day.
And she was awesome. She was super, yeah, absolutely, whatever you need. Just really nice and really calm, and she's really good with her dogs.
Niece said she learned a lot from her first 1,000-mile race and sees more of them in her future.
Oh, yeah. We'll be back next year.
Pace came into Braeburn Wednesday morning just as Niece was taking off. He said he learned a lot about leadership from his first Yukon quest. When he dropped his lead dog solo, it totally changed the dynamic of his team. He was feeling deflated, and the dogs picked up on it.
But I feel closer to recognizing how to help them and how to encourage them and how to lead with them.
On the Yukon Quest Trail in Whitehorse, I'm Molly Redig.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Matt Miller in Juneau, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Molly Redig on the Yukon Quest Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Mr. Dave Waldron, and I am Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.